come to order. Clerk will note the roll. We do have a quorum. And you guys got to keep your name tags in the right order over there.
What are you talking about?
Representative Anderson moves the minutes of March 9th. Is there any discussion regarding the minutes of March 9th? No discussion. All in favor of the minutes of March 9th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The minutes of March 9th are approved. I'm going to make a couple of announcements now, and then we will make them at the end of the meeting again. But on Wednesday, we're going to recess at 4:15 because there's some folks screwing around with the caucus, and we have to interrupt our very busy schedule to let them do that. So we're going to reconvene at 6 p.m. in room 200 to finish the agenda if we don't get it done by 4:15. We're going to start on time if we can and reconvene at 6 p.m. And in the meantime, we will let you know if there's any change in that agenda. House File 931, Representative Anderson, is going to be continued to March 22nd. So the first item on the agenda is MnDOT's truck weights and pavement presentation, which will take about an hour, and we have Ms. Parker, MnDOT Director of Government Affairs, to start the proceedings. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I just wanted to make a couple brief comments before we start. The purpose of this presentation is to give you some background in an issue that's becoming increasingly important. Heavy truck waste is a very big issue these days, and it's very important in how we design, construct, and maintain both state and local roads. We always take truck weights into account when we're designing roads. State law regulates truck weights, and there's an increasing there's a growing discussion about raising truck weights. MnDOT, in its strategic planning, has three strategic objectives, and one of them is to preserve what exists, which means to preserve the existing road system. And one of the ways that we preserve the existing road system is to limit the amount of weight that can be carried on it, because too much weight can damage pavement. We also do, though, acknowledge the needs of shippers and transporters to get goods where they need to go. And so we want you to understand that although we're going to talk today about the effects of weight on roads, this is in no way intended as a criticism of the trucking industry or of truckers in general or the need of people to get their goods to places they need to get them. So we're going to have a presentation from one of our pavement engineers, one of our bridge engineers, and from Greg Hayes, who teaches truck weight education classes both to enforcement personnel and to trucking companies so that they learn how to load their trucks properly so that they remain within state law and don't damage state roads. And I'd like to thank the committee for allowing us to have this time to make this presentation today.
This is, to my mind, a very boring subject, but very important. So everybody needs to stay awake. If you can.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chamber, what are you offering to keep us up and awake?
I can't think of anything.
Coffee for everyone.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Hayes, and I work for Northland College.
And I didn't mean your presentation. I just meant all of this, all of the weight stuff.
Okay.
No worries. Thank you for allowing me to be here. Betsy Parker has asked me to bring some information, which is some snippets out of a program that we go statewide with to help educate the industry, government officials, and whoever wants information regarding the truck laws of Minnesota. And basically, we're looking to empower them to haul the most legal weight possible, depending on the kinds of equipment that they have purchased or the kinds of equipment that they will purchase. We've expanded our training to include governmental officials, both on the city, county, and township levels. This is a program not of enforcement, but of education. And again, our goal is to give that information to the haulers so that they will voluntarily comply with the Minnesota weight laws. The program is a partnership of many different entities within Minnesota, taking care of the budget items and whatnot. Minnesota Local Technical Assistance Program, Local Research Board, and Minnesota Department of Transportation are the primary people behind our funding and marketing. I'd like to start the presentation with a snippet of a video. It's a South Dakota video, which is a remake of a Minnesota video. In 1999, the state of South Dakota was experiencing an exceptional amount of road damage. And the head of the Motor Carrier Department at that time, Myron Rao, he's a friend of mine, and he also agreed in putting education ahead of enforcement to give the people the knowledge they needed to comply with the legal waste before the enforcement blitz came on. They took a Minnesota video and updated it to show the issues and the facts that they were trying to get across regarding road damage. This is probably the best training tool I have in video format to show the issues of road damage and to show what happens when heavy trucks cross the highway. Also, it dispels some of the rumors, and you may pay attention to the portions of the video regarding road restrictions and whether or not it does serve any purpose to slow a vehicle down when driving on restricted roads. So with that, I'll let the video roll, and then I'll explain after we're done some of the issues as it pertains to Minnesota. The information that you see in the video, we're not seeing the whole thing, we're seeing just a part of it, is all relevant to Minnesota. The parts of the law that they reference are exactly the same in Minnesota as what you will see in South Dakota.
Roads are the lifeline of rural America. South Dakota roads link our communities, our homes, and our families and friends. We depend on good, safe roads to take us wherever we need to travel. Our roads carry trucks and vehicles of all shapes and sizes. Here in South Dakota, we depend on trucks. Trucks that bring us things we need, and trucks that take things we want to sell to others. But a truck that is too heavily loaded can cause serious damage to our roads. Governor Jackson has asked that we help answer an important question for our state. The question is, how heavy is too heavy for the roads of South Dakota? The governor believes that if the people of our state have an opportunity to learn more about our roads, then we can work together as South Dakotans to help reduce the damage caused by overweight trucks. So let's learn more about our roads, put on your engineer's hat, and join me for a journey over and under through our roads. Roads are engineered to carry the weight of legally loaded vehicles for many years. Two primary factors determine how long a road will last before needing major repairs or replacement: the weight and the amount of traffic. While there are many cars and vans on our roads, trucks are the primary source of damage. The damage leads to cracked and crumbled road surfaces, bone jarring potholes, and costly repairs for both our vehicles and our roads. Damage is caused by the weight placed on the road by the tires of a vehicle. A truck that is 10% overweight increases road damage by 50%. A truck loaded to be overweight by 40% increases damage by nearly 300%. The South Dakota Highway Patrol issues citations to over 3,000 overweight vehicles a year. Captain Myron Rao describes some of the damage caused by overweight trucks.
Last summer, In 1 week's time, on Highway 73 north of Phillips, trucks did $200,000 worth of damage to that highway. With those ruts as deep as they were, a car could not have driven down that highway, even in dry conditions, much less wet conditions, without losing control of their car.
Most of us think of the road as the surface we ride over. but there's much more to a word than meets the eye. Using computer animation, let's go under the road surface and see how a road is designed to carry the weight of trucks and other traffic. A typical South Dakota highway is made of three layers. The asphalt or concrete layer provides a smooth driving surface and holds the roadbed in place. A thicker gravel layer, engineers refer to as the gravel base, supports the weight of the traffic. And an even thicker layer of compacted soil, called an earthen subgrade, further distributes the weight of vehicles. The part of the road under the driving surface layer is critical to providing support for trucks and other heavy vehicles. A good road begins with a solid layer of compacted soil. Heavy construction equipment packs the earthen subgrade to make sure that the road will not settle with use. A gravel base is placed over the earthen subgrade layer and also compacted. The thickness of the gravel base is designed to distribute the weight from traffic through to the subgrade layer. If we stopped building our road at this point, we would have a gravel road. To maintain the strength of the road to carry traffic, it is important to protect the gravel base from the effects of water. Roads are built with a crown in the center to help water run off the road surface. Heavy traffic loosens the gravel at the surface, destroying the crown. When the crown is gone, water collects on the road and seeps into the gravel layer. The gravel layer becomes soft and mushy, and the road is weakened. Traffic sinks into the wet gravel, creating ruts. When the road dries, the ruts remain, and we experience a rough, damaged road. The familiar cloud of dust that follows a vehicle on the gravel road is a visible reminder of the need to answer the question, how heavy is too heavy for the roads of South Dakota? By adding a surface of asphalt or concrete, we significantly increase the life of our roads. Water can now drain off the road surface and away from the base layers. Protecting the base of the road under the surface from water is important to providing support for trucks and other heavy vehicles. The solid road base will support the asphalt or concrete surface for many years. The thickness of the asphalt surface is designed to distribute the weight from the wheels of the vehicle to the gravel base and subgrade. Asphalt pavement is used to protect some of South Dakota's county and township roads and most state highways. Concrete is better suited for the increased traffic of major city streets and high-speed traffic on our interstate highways. This simple model illustrates how the weight of the truck affects all three layers of the road structure. Notice that as the top surface is depressed by the wheels of the truck, the bottom surface is stretched. If the bottom surface stretches enough, cracks will form. Each time a heavy load passes, the cracks grow. When the cracks reach the top surface, the pavement begins to break apart. To illustrate the effect of placing an overweight truck on a road, let's return to our animation. As the load placed on this truck increases, the truck becomes overweight, and the tires place an increasing stress on all layers of the road. When this weight becomes heavier than the road was designed to carry, the bottom surface of the asphalt stretches and cracks. It is critical that these cracks in the road surface be sealed to protect the road base from the effects of water. Unsealed cracks allow rain to seep into the gravel base. Wet layers cannot provide the designed support for the asphalt surface. Each passing vehicle causes more damage and breakup of the asphalt. Soon an all-too-familiar pothole is formed. Water can more easily reach the gravel base through the pothole. The asphalt crumbles, the pothole becomes larger, and the damage to the road continues. So to answer the question, just how heavy a road is too heavy for the roads of South Dakota, let's go to our testing laboratory and take a closer look at an asphalt sample. This asphalt sample will respond to the force of this testing machine in much the same way as a road would react to the weight of traffic when the base layers have been weakened by water. The asphalt layer is a mixture of rock aggregate and a bituminous binder. A typical state highway has an asphalt layer approximately 4 inches thick. The increasing force of this testing machine represents the stress placed on asphalt by an increasingly heavy truck. The asphalt test section deflects and the bottom stretches. The crack beginning at the bottom quickly moves through to the top, just like the cracks that form from an overweight truck on a road. We place the gauge on an actual road to measure the deflection caused by the weight of this truck. As the truck passes, the road flexes. The gauge swings first to the right, indicating the push upward by the approaching wheel, and then to the left as the asphalt is deflected. After the wheel passes, the road rebounds to the original position. This animation goes below the asphalt surface and illustrates what the gauge measured on our actual road. The animation magnifies the effects of deflection on the road layers. The heavier the weight on the tire, the more the road will deflect. Let's place another section of an asphalt road in our testing machine. This time we will let the machine apply many cycles of the same weight to simulate the passage of normal traffic. This dial gauge shows that this section of asphalt is flexing from the testing machine, just like the road flexed with the passing truck. After many flexes, the asphalt fatigues and cracks develop. Each overload truck speeds up this fatigue process, and the asphalt surface will fail sooner. This crack is an example of how the deflection from the tires of trucks over a water-weakened subbase causes damage to a road. While reducing and repairing cracks in the asphalt or concrete road surface protects the supporting base from the effects of rainwater, water can also enter and weaken the supporting layers in other ways. The recent wet years in northeastern South Dakota have turned farm fields into wetlands and lakes. Roads that were once solid are now surrounded by water. This animation illustrates how standing water along our roads travels into the earthen subgrade and gravel base. As these layers become saturated, the surface layer can no longer support the weight of traffic. Many of these roads have been elevated and rebuilt to better protect the supporting base layers from the effects of the nearby water. The cost to repair some flooded roads is simply too great, and the roads have been closed. The impact of water entering the supporting base layers of an asphalt road is demonstrated in this test made by the United States Forest Service. Each time the truck travels this section, the asphalt deflects. The deflection caused by a truck traveling on a dry road is small and is difficult to observe. But because the supporting base of this road has been weakened by water, the deflection from the passing truck is large and highly visible. The asphalt surface fatigues from the deflection, just like the asphalt section in the laboratory test. Cracks form, and the road begins to break up. After only 81 passes, the asphalt road is severely damaged. Here in South Dakota, there is no way to avoid the effects of weather on our roads. During the winter, our roads are at their strongest when moisture in the gravel base and subbase freezes. But with the quickly changing temperatures that can occur in the spring, our roads are at their weakest and can be easily damaged. As the temperature begins to warm up to near freezing, the sun on the black road surface begins to thaw the frozen layer just beneath the asphalt. As this frost melts, the base becomes saturated, turning into a soft slurry. But the earth and subbase is still frozen. The weakened gravel base can no longer support the weight of traffic, and the asphalt becomes damaged. So how do we protect our water-weakened roads in the spring? We lower the weight limits on many South Dakota roads to try to control damage. These spring load limits are established by the respective county commissioners and enforced by the South Dakota Highway Patrol. It may seem that lowering the speed limit would reduce damage during the spring thaw. But in fact, lowering speed limits can actually cause additional damage to weakened roads, because the pavement has to support a slow-moving vehicle for a longer period of time. The only effective way to protect our roads during the spring thaw is to lower the weight limits. Kurt Jones, a farmer and former legislator, says that loading a truck to carry the maximum legal weight is not always easy.
There's a number of combinations that determine that. First off, what product you're hauling, there's variation of weights. Wheat is much heavier than corn. Barley's usually lighter yet. Oats are a lot lighter. So it's hard to say, but you just fill it through this line and that's it. Every load changes. We have got a grain cart now, and when we bought it, we put a scale on that grain cart. So we can tell how many gross pounds we're putting on that truck. And I guess because I'm a farmer, I'm aware of all the problems that we run into as farmers trying to stay legal. That's the third truck that we've gone to tandem on. Costly for us.
Mr. Jones feels that overweight vehicles create costly damage to our rural roads.
It becomes more important by the day that we address this overweight problem. The township roads right here by the farm, they're getting costly. So we have to face up the reality that we can't carry overweight loads.
So how can South Dakotans reduce the damage from overweight vehicles?
Well, I think the very best thing that could be done is for all of us as farmers to have a comfortable dealing with the people who are administering the weight laws and spend some time dealing with them as we have earlier here today so that we really know what we can haul.
The South Dakota Department of Transportation and the Highway Patrol provide a motor carrier handbook that includes tables and examples of weight limits authorized by the South Dakota legislature. Weight limits are determined by the number of axles, the distance between axles, and tire width. It is important to know how much load a truck can carry before it becomes overweight and causes damage to our roads. Let's calculate the maximum legal weight of this truck. The tires of the steering axle can carry a maximum weight of 600 pounds per inch of tire width. Since these tires are 10 inches wide, they may each place a weight of 6,000 pounds on the road. Together, they can transfer a maximum weight of 12,000 pounds. It is possible to increase the width of the tires and carry more weight. However, the established legal weight for a steering axle is 20,000 pounds, regardless of tire width. The maximum weight for a non-steering axle is limited to 500 pounds per inch of tire width. Each of the 10-inch wide tires of this axle has a maximum weight limit of 5,000 pounds. The combined maximum weight of these four tires, 20,000 pounds, equals the maximum permissible limit for this axle. The maximum gross weight of 12,000 pounds for the steering axle and a maximum weight of 20,000 pounds for the non-steering axle limit the maximum legal gross weight of this truck to 32,000 pounds.
4581 amendment.
Okay.
It deletes two sections of the bill, section 1 on page 1 and pages 4 and 5. It deletes section 5. And it asks the revisor to renumber the sections and amend the title accordingly.
Everybody has the amendments in front of them. Any discussion on the amendment? If not, those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, anyway, let's get started with this. We have a housekeeping bill put forth by the MnDOT, and we have Eric Rubin, representative from MnDOT, that will explain the bill for us.
Mr. Rudine, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine, MnDOT Government Affairs, and I'll just run through the bill fairly quickly. Section 1, we've just deleted, but perhaps with the indulgence of the committee, I could just explain that because we're planning to reintroduce that. In fact, the two sections we just deleted have been reintroduced in a separate bill that was referred to the Finance Committee, but just so the members are aware, when these issues reach the floor, Section 1 would create a revolving account for the pavement striping program, allowing that program to operate more like an independent business. And we did this, not for the pavement striping program, but for the state sign shop. We did this for the pavement program a couple years ago, and it's worked pretty well. Section 2 of the bill is the logo sign program, which are the big blue signs that you see on the side of the freeways. And current law says that in order to have a sign up, food must be prepared on the premises, which means that coffee shops, which might sell food but don't prepare it on the premises, cannot have one of those signs. And we've been approached by Caribou, and they'd like to have those signs up, and we feel it's appropriate. Other states have now allowed coffee shops to have signs. Sections 3 and 6 of the bill deal with an expedited process for state aid operations rules, and these rules concern the internal processes and design standards for our municipal and county state aid highway systems. They're revised every 2 to 3 years, and currently we have to follow the full process for rules adoption in Chapter 14 of Minnesota statutes. Chapter 14 already contains an expedited process that we feel would better fit for our state aid operations rules, because we already have heavy involvement from cities and counties in adopting these rules. And our staff can only remember one request for a public hearing since the 1980s, and we would follow a normal procedure where if there was substantial interest in a rule or had numerous requests for public hearing, we would still go through the full process. But for the more mundane types of rules, we'd be able to follow this more expedited process. Sections 4 and 7 would shorten the comment period for variances from state aid rules from 20 days to 7 days. And again, these have heavy involvement from our local partners, the counties and municipalities. In Minnesota rules already, variance requests must be in the form of a county board or a city council resolution. And so the local governments would have worked with their residents before they even come to us with a variance request. And we feel that in order to expedite projects, 7 days is an appropriate comment period. And just for way of information, our state aid staff can only recall one time when anybody provided input to the variance committee on a variance request, and that was somebody that was speaking in support of the request. Section 5, again, we deleted, but just so you're aware what that does, it would increase the administrative withholding in the county state aid highway fund. And it would mean about $2 million less per year that would go out to county state aid highways. However, this is a request of the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's in their legislative platform. And it's money that would be used for statewide programs that benefited all counties. You might be aware of the 10-ton map that we've developed with counties. Also, money from this account could be used to match federal funds. And any unspent money in the administrative account goes out into the county state aid highway system. Section 8 removes a cap on advances from the municipal state aid street fund. Currently, there's a 3-year cap. There were two cities, Sartell and Shoreview, which were recently limited by this language, and we feel that we can manage the fund with our state aid staff because the number of projects are very small, and cities would be consulted on the use of this fund as always, but we feel that for certain projects, large scale projects, if a city wants to borrow more than 3 years from their appropriation, that we should allow them to do that. Sections 9 and 10 of the bill allow a city or a county to transition a project a short distance across a county line or city boundary to the most logical terminus of a particular project. Both jurisdictions would have to agree to the construction in advance, and it would have to be approved by the commissioner of MnDOT. There's already a section in state statute 161.26 that allows the state to do this if we have a project going across the state border, for example, a bridge project or something like that. Sections 11 and 12 deal with pedestrian safety, and these changes will bring state statutes into conformance with what's called the Uniform Vehicle Code and the MUTCD, which is the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. And these manuals are what traffic engineers use, and they are updated periodically to reflect changes in state statute, and so we're kind of catching up state law to what has been updated in these manuals. the if you need any more information on those manuals, I can provide it, but I'll just go through the changes that are in the bill. In Section 11, Subdivision 5, we would amend state law to allow that a word or a symbol can be used on pedestrian signals. As you know, many signals currently display an upraised hand or a walking person instead of the words walk and don't walk. Technically, that's not allowed under the law. On the top of page 8, subdivision 5A1-3 would incorporate language in the federal manual on uniform traffic control devices. States that all drivers must yield the right-of-way to a pedestrian unless the vehicle was lawfully in an intersection when the light changes. Then on the top of page 9, we would add the word lawfully to the requirement that drivers yield to pedestrians and other traffic when making left-hand turns from one-way streets onto other one-way streets. The word lawfully already appears in Clause A above that, and it's in also both the federal and state MUTCD. Bottom of page 9, subdivision 5A3, sub 3 requires that drivers making turns on red lights yield the right-of-way to pedestrians and other traffic. And on page 10, section 12 would allow, again, the word or symbol to be used on pedestrian signals, and it also makes clear that pedestrians have the right-of-way when they're in conflict with turning vehicles. And it finally incorporates provision of Section 11 above, requiring that drivers yield the right-of-way to a pedestrian unless the vehicle was lawfully in the intersection when the light changes. Section 13 of the bill deals with exempt railroad crossings. Currently, state law says that if there are 5 or fewer trains at a crossing per year, that we post those crossings as exempt, which means that school buses, vehicles carrying hazardous materials, and vehicles for hire are not required to stop at those railroad crossings. We would like the ability to post other crossings as exempt where appropriate and with agreement from the operating railroad. And we would look at crossings with probably fewer than 12 trains per year. There are certain circumstances where if it's near an intersection, there are rear-end collisions that are happening at some of these low-volume crossings. And so we get requests from cities and from our own traffic engineers, but because state law says 5 or fewer per year, we cannot post those as exempt. And once a crossing is posted as exempt, if it's going to be used by a train, the railroad is required to go out with a flagger or hire an off-duty police officer to go stand at that crossing while it's being used. So it should actually increase safety, we feel. Section 14 of the bill deals with the Commuter Rail Coordinating Committee. There's a state law which provided that all advisory committees sunsetted on June 30th, 2003, unless otherwise exempted. And the revisor's office brought this to our attention over the interim that this wasn't specifically exempted from that sunset, and so we would like to extend that. There's one meeting currently for the North Star Corridor. There's also a coordinating committee meeting for the Red Rock Corridor. Sections 15 and 16 deal with a new federal rule that you may have heard about regarding quiet zones and the sounding of rail whistles. Any community that wants to maintain a quiet zone will have to reapply to the Federal Railroad Administration, and certain cities may be forced to expend additional funds for safety equipment at certain crossings if they want to maintain a quiet zone. But the FRA will work with the local community. Our office has already met with several communities to inform them of this new rule. The community will have between 5 and 8 years probably to implement any additional safety equipment that's required. And then regarding the sounding of whistles, there's no longer a fixed distance. State law reads 80 rods, but now it's 15 to 20 seconds before a train reaches the crossing. And then Section 17 are just some technical instructions to the revisor, made necessary by the shortened comment periods in Sections 4 and 7 of the bill. With that, we'd be happy to take questions. We also have experts here if there are technical questions that arise.
Questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rudin, the establishment of quiet zones, am I reading this right to say it's going to be more difficult for communities to establish a quiet zone?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that's correct, and it's really nothing that we're doing at the state level. As I said, this is a new federal rule that's going into effect. So regardless of whether we make this change in state law, the federal rule will still supersede whatever we have in state statute.
Mr. Chair,
and Representative Olson.
Mr. Rudin, so this is basically a provision to comply and make our laws consistent with the federal rules so that there's clear understanding as to what needs to be done. Is that right?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that's correct. And as I said, our Office of Railroads has already begun meeting with communities to explain to them the steps that they'll have to follow working with the Federal Railroad Administration. There's been some media attention to this issue because of the, as you said, it's going to be more difficult for communities to have quiet zones in some cases. But each crossing will have to be reevaluated, and they'll have to reapply to Federal Railroad Administration if they want to have a quiet zone in their community.
So, Mr. Chair, to some people, this is a big issue. In fact, I was just contacted on it the other day. They're going to actually have to reapply and reestablish the quiet zones they even have.
Mr. Rudin?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's my understanding, yes.
Mr. Chair, can we overturn this somehow?
Mr. Chair, as I said, this is a federal rule, so unless there is some federal exemption granted...
you could run for Congress for this.
Everyone else
is... other questions for Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Harwell, Mr. Rudin, I take it that this has gone before, because it deals with rules, it's gone before government operations, and they've approved and they feel good about the rules that were brought forward, that are bringing forward in this bill.
Representative Harwell?
It has gone before the government operations committee, and they looked at those applicable parts of the bill and okayed it.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Rudin, you talk about a section in here that says construction across another county or a state. And I'm just wondering, are there no provisions now in law that allow us to work between the state of Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota? Are there, that's, we've got to put that in provision and...
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is for state highways, and so we have that authority in 161.26, but there is no authority for county state aid highways or municipal state aid streets, either for a border state or often in the case of counties, you know, if they have an intersection on a county border, it might make sense to redo that intersection as part of a county project. And they currently do not have authority to expend county state aid highway funds outside their county border. So this would allow, upon resolution by each county board and approval by the commissioner of MnDOT, allow them to expend their funds in that manner.
Okay. And Mr. Rudin, you said you're extending the deadline for the commuter rail corridor to what date? You said that you're extending it from... June 30th, 2003, to what's your date that you're going to sunset again? We don't have it in here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we are not proposing a sunset for the Commuter Rail Coordinating Committee. We feel that commuter rail is hopefully here if the legislature provides funding this year, and that even with the development of the North Star line, there are other lines that could be potentially either within 10 years, maybe not till within 30 years in certain circumstances that are potentials for commuter rail, and so we would propose making that coordinating committee permanent.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Rudin, does that coordinating committee receive money from the state as far as or finances from the counties to keep going?
They don't receive any state money, Mr. Chair. Counties do have the ability to tax for commuter rail purposes through their regional rail authorities. But this is these are coordinating committees that advise the commissioner, and they do not receive state funding.
But they could receive county or local regional rail authority money.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Which comes from the state or the federal government?
Mr. Chair, the regional rail authority money generally comes from property taxes that the county levies as a regional rail authority.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody in the audience that wishes to speak for or against House File 945? Not Representative Anderson, you want to renew your motion as amended?
I will renew my motion, Mr. Chairman, the House File 945 as amended be passed and right over for a possible inclusion in the omnibus policy, the transportation policy bill.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Thank you.
Motion prevails. Next up is House File 1053, Representative Severson.
Good job, Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Deja vu. Move your bill there, Representative Severson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1053 as previously amended to be pulled off of the transportation omnibus bill and placed under the general register.
Representative Severson has moved to remove House File 1053 off the table for reconsideration to pass as amended and move to the general register.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And I could just speak to that for a moment. The Senate file has passed and is on the floor there, and it's kind of one of those bills where I would like to get moved as soon as we could, so I would like to include it onto the general register for consideration to allow the full body to vote on it.
Mm-hmm. Discussion on Representative Severson's motion.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is on the way to general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, Representative Moore, House File, Senate File number 735.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. And please, let's see. Representative Reeder moves.
I'd like to move House File 735, or Senate File, I guess it is. Senate file, we don't
have. Yeah, it's Senate File 735.
Right.
It's passed and sent to the general register.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Representative Frank Moe, and I have with me Bruce Waggy. This is a fairly straightforward bill. In fact, it was the first request made of me after being elected to office. And also, it's nice that there's no cost to the state for this bill. Perhaps that's why I have a hearing here, for which I'm grateful. The proposal in front of you is to rename dedicate a bridge in Cass County near Outing, Minnesota, as the Bradley Waggy Memorial Bridge. This is because the engineer for that bridge was a Department of Transportation employee, had a heart attack on the way home from the job, and the family has a home near there where they have family gatherings in the summer, and they would like to memorialize their family member and their brother in this case by having plaques on that bridge. The family has agreed to pay all costs for the state will incur for those plaques. And with that, I'd like to, unless there's any questions, I'd like to ask Mr. Wagy to speak here.
This is Dan Fowler. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Bruce Wagy. My brother Bradley was a road construction inspector and supervisor for MnDOT for several years. One of his last projects was the reconstruction of Highway 6 and the construction of the new bridge at the Narrows at Outing, where it goes across Lake Roosevelt. He had a heart attack when he was leaving a job site, and it was fatal. He did not make it back to the office at the end of one day. And the family was just pleasantly amazed at how many people from MnDOT showed up at his funeral because he was thought so highly of. We refer to that bridge in the family now as Uncle Brad's bridge already because he was so instrumental in the construction of that bridge. And we're hoping that you'll approve this request to have that bridge memorialized to Bradley Wagy, so that when we have our family reunion every 4th of July, we have upwards of 60 people cross that bridge on the way to the family reunion every day or every year, and on 4th of July weekend. And we were thinking it'd be just so neat if... if on the way to the reunion, we'd all see his name on that bridge. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to add a couple of things. This bill is co-sponsored by Representative Larry Howes, who's co-authored by Larry Howes, whose district this bridge connects to the district I represent. This bill was carried in the Senate and is passed in the Senate by our Republican Senator Kerry Howes, or Kerry Ruth, excuse me. So it's a bipartisan effort.
All right. Are there any other questions or comments?
Which one is it?
Representative
Ozaki. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howe, I just want to make sure that the Outing residents are in favor of this, and if you can tell me the meaning of Brainerd Brad, I'd appreciate that, too.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I must admit to not having polled all the Outing residents. As you can imagine, it's a pretty dispersed area. In fact, the district I represent, you know, is fairly large, and Outing's about 2.5-hour drive from my house. Though I do know this particular family is in support of it, and the Department of Transportation has no objection. The regional supervisor knows about it, and Mr. Wagy also has a letter from the DOT about the project.
Yeah. Brainerd Brad is a nickname that was given to him by MnDOT employees.
So. Any other questions or comments? If not, all in favor of Senate File 735, move it, excuse me. Representative Reeder is moving House File 735 be passed and sent to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. House File 735. Aye. Senate File 735 will be sent to the General Register. I don't thank you so much for coming in and...
I thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Vinny.
We're looking for a representative... thank you. Is he here? Oh, he is, sir. I look like Kubrick to me. I thought it was...
He blends in with the chairs.
Yeah. Okay. Who wants to move whatever this bill is? It has no title. What is it?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 1452 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus transportation policy bill.
Representative Junkie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor, as always, to be at the Transportation Committee. And for members, Representative Earhart called me Kubli because in 96, Kubli and I were elected at the same time. And invariably, every time I'd show up in a committee and he'd address me from your seats, he'd call me Kubli. And I didn't know if it was on purpose or not, but the joke continues. Members, this is a bill should be fairly straightforward. This was in last year's Transportation Omnibus Bill, and we know what happened last year to a lot of our omnibus bills. Long story, as short as I can, DAC, Day Activity Center buses, I think most of you are familiar with them. You see the DAC on the top, and they run around our districts and pick up mentally handicapped folks to work at these centers around our counties. What I found out last year was we had a road detour in Wilmer as they were, or in New London Spicer area where they were redoing Highway 23. Upon the detour, it came by a house where one of these DAC clients lived, and the bus that usually picked them up was still picking them up. However, now the traffic had become a state highway traffic instead of a residential street traffic situation, and the parent called me and was worried about their 19 or 20-year-old child crossing the street and getting on the bus. And I said, well, I don't understand why they're not putting out the stop arms and just getting the person safely on the bus. Turns out, in Minnesota law, for whatever reason, if you're not allowed to use those stop arms on DAC buses. So basically what this bill does is that if it's a bus, equipped as a bus, driven by a bus driver with the endorsement, and on a specified route, picking up clientele for the sender, or it's not just a random traveling bus, they would be allowed to use the stop arm and the safety equipment. It's as straightforward as that. I can't believe that they couldn't, but they couldn't, and we have to do this to make sure, again, that these folks can get on the bus safely. Even though they're 19 or 20 and adults, which is probably the reason that it's not allowed, we certainly know the mental capacity of a lot of these folks is much younger, and for their safety and for the well-being of their families, we want to make sure they could cross and get on these rigs safely. So that's my bill.
Representative Anderson, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Junkie, it says here transporting adults to and from a day activity center may be equipped. Are some of these buses not equipped with the
Representative Kubli.
I got to think of a name for him, members. What line are you looking at, Representative Anderson?
I'm on line 12.
On page 1?
Yes.
To and from... maybe, I don't know. Mr. Chair, I'd refer to counsel who wrote the language that's sitting at the table.
Mr. Williams, you know that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, this language was requested as an authorization for these vehicles to be able to use the stop arm signal. I don't believe that there was a request that all of them be required to have it. That would have been expanded the scope of the bill considerably.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Williams, or Mr. Representative Junkie, I'm just, the way you had presented it, it sounded like those type of buses had already pre-warning, you know, and so I was surprised to see May thinking that these...
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question. I think the way Mr. Williams explained it is right. Not all the buses may have them, but the ones that do, certainly, and are driven by a licensed driver, et cetera, should be able to operate them just like... These buses I'm talking about in my area are regular orange school buses, you know, but there probably are some... Oh, I don't know where. Maybe you all can help me if you've seen any. Most of them are school buses. I think they've all moved to that. In the past, there probably were some private more buses that may or may not have had the equipment, but I think for the most part, they're all equipped nowadays.
So,
but if they don't have it, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, they don't have it, they can't obviously use it or operate it that way.
But, Mr. Chair...
Representative Anderson.
Representative Junkie, then you're also saying that should they have them, you're also giving the operator the jurisdiction of saying he may activate Right. He doesn't have to act.
Right. And Mr. Chair, that's correct. We're not requiring this. It's not. It's up to the discretion of the driver and probably the bus company and the parents and everyone else. But at least right now, they cannot legally put the stop arm out on these buses. We're just saying at your discretion, and if the traffic warrants and other conditions, you can put it out.
So use your common sense.
Correct.
Any other questions or comments? If not, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1452 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Policy Bill. All in favor of that amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill is passed, and we will keep it for the policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
thank
members.
You. I just have an announcement again. We've changed the time that we'll be reassembling, if we have to 7 p.m. tomorrow. So we'll start at time, try to get everything done by the time 4:15 will be around, and if we have to come back, it'll be 7 rather than 6. Thank you.
This room?
What?
This room?
It's in 200.
200.
Well, wait a minute. We're going to reconvene in 200.
In 200.
But we will start here.
We'll start here.
We will start here.
If you
yes.
Tell
us, we'll
go to 200.
But reconvene in 200. Excuse me.
Would you tell me?
Anybody got anything else? Well, otherwise, we're going to adjourn.
A maximum legal weight of a truck can be significantly increased by placing two axles close together in a configuration called tandem axles. The eight tires of these axles transfer the increased weight in a manner that minimizes road wear. The tandem axles can place a maximum weight of 34,000 pounds on a road. The 10-inch wide tires of the steering axle can carry a maximum weight of 12,000 pounds. Together, the axles can carry a maximum legal weight of 46,000 pounds. While these two trucks have identical load boxes, the truck with the tandem axles can legally carry more weight. This five-axle truck is commonly referred to as an 18-wheeler. The 18 tires distribute the heavy weight this truck is designed to legally carry. Tandem axles are used as an efficient way to increase the maximum legal weight. Again, the 10-inch tires of the steering axle can carry a maximum weight of 12,000 pounds. Each of the sets of tandem axles can carry a maximum weight of 34,000 pounds. By combining the maximum weights for the axles and tires, this truck can legally place a maximum gross weight of 80,000 pounds on the road. As we answer the question, how heavy is too heavy for the roads of South Dakota? It is important to recognize that big trucks aren't necessarily overweight trucks. Trucks can be designed with many axles to limit the weight placed on the road by the tires. Multiple axle trucks can safely carry huge amounts of weight without damaging our roads.
It gets pretty specific in the stuff that probably wouldn't be any use to you today after that point. Nevertheless, those issues that are addressed in that video are some of the issues that we address in the classroom with the students right now, as far as when it pays to add axles, when it pays to get different tires on your trucks and things of that nature. The one thing that is unique, or that we have to deal with in Minnesota, is we have two tiers of weights in Minnesota. We've got one set of weights for the state highway system, for the U.S. highway system, and the interstate highway system. Those are called 10-ton routes. Gets its name from the amount of weight allowed on a single axle, 10 ton, 20,000 pounds. And counties can designate some of their roads as 10-ton routes also. This is the national standard. This is the 80,000-pound truck on five properly spaced axles. Everything that is not those highways, meaning your county highways, your township highways, and your city streets, are 9-ton routes. And that same 80,000-pound truck that's operating on the interstate system gets off onto the county system. Unless that system is designated with higher weights, the truck is going to be overweight almost 7,000 pounds. Same axle loads, just the gross weight drops from 80,000 pounds to 73,280 pounds. So there's a disparity for the trucker that comes into the state on the state highway system or the national system and has to make a delivery on a county or township route. He may be legal for thousands of miles, but by turning off from that 10-ton route onto the county route, there's nearly a 7,000-pound overweight right there. This is the configuration of a nationally recognized 80,000-pound truck. 80,000 pounds, 5 axles. It's good on all the 10-ton route systems, which, again, are your U.S. highways, your state highways, your interstate highways. The same truck, exactly the same axle weights, pulls off onto the county or township routes. The maximum weight drops from 80,000 pounds to 73,280 pounds. So you have, again, that disparity between the county and the municipal system and the state system, the state and federal system. Both systems allow 80,000 pounds with the rig that has 6 properly spaced axles. And part of our training is to show them where to put those 6 axles so they can get the 80,000 pounds. But with 6 axles properly spaced, you have seamless transportation between the county system and the state system. And that's why you'll see some contractors that are operating on the, oh, let's say they're hauling asphalt or hauling gravel off on the state system. Many of the times they have 6 axles. They're doing that so they can haul that seamless transportation from the county to the state system. In 2004, the legislation was changed to allow the county engineers, in most cases, the ability to designate their own highways as 10-ton. So if they have a highway in their system, be it county or city, that is capable of hauling additional weight, the law says, okay, as long as you don't damage the road, we're going to allow you to increase those weights. These are where the highways are in Minnesota. The top one is the interstate highways. It does not represent a lot of miles, but it does represent a lot of traffic, as you know. The second one is your state highway systems. Those top two are the 10-ton routes. There's where your 80,000-pound trucks are. But if you look beyond that into the county, municipal, and township, those are your 9-ton routes. How many of those trucks that stay on the interstate and the state highway never have to make a delivery onto the county or city system? If they do, if they're 80,000 pounds on 5 axles, they turn off onto that road, they're overweight by nearly 7,000 pounds. The impact of trucks is found by the Bureau of Mines in South Dakota. One legal truck, 80,000-pound truck, has the same impact on a road as 9,600 cars. So when you start adding the heavier trucks to the county systems, to the township systems that weren't designed for the weights, you can imagine the road life is going to decrease rather rapidly. By increasing that overweight, or making that truck overweight by just 20%, you can add roughly another 10,000 cars. It's not twice the weight, twice the damage. In this case, only a 20% overload, and you're almost doubling the damage. The overview of the overweight issues are you deal mainly in maximum legal weights. You'll hear of the 80,000 pounds or the 73,280 or the 90,000 pounds. But the weights, if they're exceeded, trickle onto other components of the truck. And each one of these components is another law and is another violation. So a truck that's grossly overweight is not only over on the gross weight, it's over on the axle weights, which have their limits. It's over on the wheel weights, which have their limits. And finally, under the tire weights, which have their limits. So a fat truck is very damaging in more than one perspective, that just being the gross weight. Minnesota allows variable load axles. A variable load axle is when you go down the highway and you see one of these trucks with the axles that aren't on the ground, kind of suspended from the truck. That's a variable load axle. They're legal. You can have a switch in Minnesota that allows that axle to come off the ground when you're empty and on the ground when you're loaded. And they're used quite frequently in the construction company. The law does not allow the driver to mess with the weight press on the tire while they're driving down the highway. That valve has to be out of reach of the driver so that they can't mess with the weight that's on that axle. The gross weight in Minnesota, we subscribe to a gross weight chart that's based off the federal chart. It's a weight chart like this. You saw something like this in the video. The officer was explaining it to the farmer. And that is what determines what the weights are in Minnesota. We look at the chart and we determine how far are the axles between one another and apply the weight to the chart. Without explanation, without education, this chart can be damaging. You can draw some real bad conclusions from it. So it needs explanation. By itself, it doesn't do that much good. The general rule of thumb is more distance, more weight. During the winter, as you're aware, there's 10% increases on the weight. When the roads are frozen, much as you saw in the video, they're supposed to be at their strongest. And the state law allows for increased weights. The winter load increases, are applied differently around the state, depending on the zone, depending on the freeze index, and depending on the dates that the commissioner authorizes them. People that are in the trucking industry can subscribe to a website or web address and get these notifications right on their home computer if they have a computer. So there's a way that they can take advantage of additional weight in the wintertime. During the winter, they need a Department of Transportation permit to haul anything over this chart, basically over the 80,000 pounds, or over the single axle weight, only when operating on the interstate highway, and that's because of a federal mandate. So for them to take advantage of increasing the weights on the interstate system, it requires a Department of Transportation permit. Other than that, a permit is not needed, and they can haul the overweights subject to any bridge postings or issues by local road authorities. A couple years ago, the legislation was changed to allow the same winter weights on county routes as state highways. And this was to provide, again, seamless transportation between the county system and the state system at a time when the roads are frozen. So this would allow that same five-axle truck that's normally legal at 88,000 pounds on the state system to operate that way on the county system, providing the county road authorities don't have any issues, again, with bridges or roads at risk. During the harvest, there's additional weight increases for only three commodities, sugar beets, carrots, and potatoes. It does not apply to any of the grain crops. And the intent behind this was to allow the ground crops to get out of the ground before freeze-up. The harvest weight increase, as it's known, a permit is required to operate in excess of the normal legal weights when they're on the state highways. These increases start from the beginning of harvest to November 30th each year. So if they start harvesting potatoes in July, this would be valid in July. A permit is needed, again, only on the on the state highways. These weights are not valid on the interstate highways because of the federal law. They're not valid on the county or township routes unless they have a permitting, a way to permit on those routes. And they're not valid on the city routes. This, again, causes a little disparity. I'm from the sugar beet country, and only 20% of all the sugar beet pilers are on the state highways. Most of them are on your county and township routes. During the spring road restrictions, as you're aware, from the video, the roads are at risk. The power from the local road authority says that any time roads are at risk, they can restrict them to a lesser damage to prevent weight from damaging. Minnesota city, county, and township routes that are not posted, in other words, there's no sign on them during road restrictions, are 5-ton by statute. This means that they don't have to go around and post all of their roads. If it's unposted and it's a county, a city, or township route, it becomes 5-ton. Gross weights during that time of the year are a byproduct of the axle weights. There could be enough axles under it to allow the same legal maximum weights, but would probably not be cost effective because your truck would weigh so much empty it wouldn't be worth hauling anything by the time you added all the axles. Here's an example of a signage where the local road authority has posted the highway to basically keep trucks off during road restrictions. So that's a case of them using the optional power to reduce the road limits. School buses are allowed 14,000 pounds per single axle. Normally 10,000 is all you're allowed, but the statute says for the purposes of picking up children and Head Start, we're going to allow that axle to go up to 14,000 pounds. Utility vehicles. If we get an ice storm at a time when road restrictions are on, there are exemptions there to allow those two or three axle vehicles to go out during the ice storm for the purposes of restoring power. And emergency power restoration is what makes them legal out there. As you're also aware, the refuse and garbage industry last year had a modification to the law, and this would allow the refuse and garbage vehicles to operate up to 7 tons per axle during road restrictions, where they would normally be allowed 10,000 pounds. This is due to sunset this July 1st. Some of the special exemptions and limitations, and this is just brief, towed implements of husbandry, those grain carts, they cannot exceed 500 pounds per inch of tire width. In order for the law to apply, they must be pneumatic tires. They can't be on tracks because then they're exempt. And they must be a towed implement of husbandry. Most of these vehicles are meant to be off-road vehicles. They're meant to be in the fields. I have a friend who farms 13,000 acres. They put 80,000 pounds of commodity into a grain cart. And it's meant to be in the field. If you pull them up on the road, the regulation that regulates them is the pounds per inch of tire width, which will probably drop the gross vehicle weight in most cases to 40,000 pounds. Right now they're being manufactured at 1,500 bushels in the state of Minnesota. so the potential of overweights on a state highway is very high if they come on the roads. For forest products, Minnesota law allows a 5% tolerance of all of the weights across the board when not operated on a defense highway. And in Minnesota, for the purposes of defining a defense highway, it's an interstate highway. So this gives 5% on the axle weights, 5% on the gross weight, as long as they don't exceed the tire ratings. That's for the forest products. For raw and unfinished forest products, trucks that are traveling the most direct route to the nearest 10-ton route, so they can be out in the woods, they can be out in the townships, they can be out in the counties, if they're traveling the most direct route to a 10-ton route, they can operate on any unrestricted road with the transportation permit, and that weight will allow them to go up to 90,000 pounds in the summer and 98,000 pounds in the winter. The vehicles must have 6 axles, all with brakes on them, and it goes on to explain the kinds of combinations. This permit is not valid on the interstate highways. But this allows that seamless transportation from the county and township routes out to the nearest 10-ton route. The permit is $300 for the power unit, in other words, for the truck, and they can haul variable trailers with that. The trucks must comply with the seasonal road restrictions. They must comply with bridge postings. They must comply with any posting. And again, the weights over 80,000 pounds in the summer and over 88 in the winter are not valid on the interstate routes. That's due to federal regulation. Now, there is a way to haul logs and other commodities on the interstate during the winter, and that's with that 10% winter load increase. And that would allow that same logger to haul up to 88,000 pounds on 5 proper legally spaced axles. And again, all the axle weights must be legal. They don't get the 5% tolerance there. They must buy enough license plate weight to cover the truck. And the 10% applies to all the axle weights. Now, you've probably undoubtedly heard about other states that have higher weights than Minnesota. Minnesota and North Dakota, for example, have 105,000. They were grandfathered in at the time that we made some changes. So they can legally haul 105,000 with various combinations, especially along the border of Minnesota and North Dakota, and South Dakota now, too. So those trucks are bound to stay in that state without something that will let them come into Minnesota. They have to break down and come in separate units. So that concludes my brief overview, and this is a 6-hour class. I've tried to condense to 25 minutes, and I apologize if I lost you in there. If there's any questions, I'll take them at this time. If not, I'll turn it over to another presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but I think it's very important to stress what happens on the bridge. You talked about bridge postings, but that's a critical factor, really.
That's correct, and that is stressed, that the bridges are the ultimate governing authority of the truck weight at the bridge.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forget your name.
Greg Hayes.
Greg Hayes?
Yes.
Mr. Hayes, you mentioned that the posting for, I think, garbage trucks, the weight limits are going off this spring. Is there been any follow-up on what's taken place in this year of those trucks being allowed to have that 7-ton limit? Anything that's derogatory or, you know, to show that it's something that we don't want to continue?
Mr. Hayes?
There may be engineers who are here that can answer that question. It's not something that I'm aware of, what the results of that were.
Thank you.
Representative Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hayes, when you referred to purchasing overweight permits and things, if the truck needs to be overweight from time to time, where does the money for that go? Does that find its way back into the people, to the areas that are in control of the roads?
To my knowledge, it does not, but there are people that are more qualified to answer that than me here and that may be presenting shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
We have some other testifiers. I don't know who's going to introduce them, but...
My name is Kurt Turgeon. I'm the MnDOT pavement engineer. And I'll keep talking and move some things around here. My job, I'm in charge of pavement design, pavement management, which is the accounting system. We keep track of the performance of all our roads, as well well as the Bethune specifications and factory specifications.
That's a great scene right there. Can you leave that up there?
Came with the computer. the video that Mr. Hayes showed did an excellent job of explaining a lot of the points that I was going to make, so I'll move through those briefly, and I'm sure you won't, I'll try and keep you awake. As it kind of alluded to in the video, we actually have five seasons when we're considering pavement design. Summer, when the asphalt's slightly weaker because it's soft. Fall, it's slightly stronger. In the winter, the pavement's at its best because everything's frozen, everything's stiff, and everything's carrying the load, spreading the load quite effectively. In the early spring, the upper layers begin to thaw out, and we begin to lose a lot of strength. And ultimately, in late spring, when everything thaws, everything's saturated, that is when the pavement's at its weakest. So we consider five different seasons when we're trying to design a pavement. As it showed in the video very well, you put a load on the pavement deflects, the bottom fibers get into tension, and how many times you can expect those fibers to get stretched and relaxed is what you're up against as far as designing a pavement. In this slide, we basically took a road that was designed for 7 tons, and as you can see, if you take a car axle and you apply that car axle to a road designed for 7 tons, you get just a very small amount of deflection, 3.8 mils or thousandths of an inch. And you could essentially, in terms of structural capacity at least, you could drive a car across that road forever and it will never wear out. Now if you take the road, the axle that it's designed for, a 7-ton axle, and you drive it on that same piece of pavement, it's going to deflect quite a bit more, and you can see you can load it up about 225,000 times until it's going to wear out. But if you take a 7-ton road and you apply 10-ton axle to that road, you can see you decrease the amount of loads to failure by less than half. And this is what, again, classic structural damage looks like, is when those bottom fibers have completely given up, and you can see that right down the wheel path is where all the deflection has happened, where the road is coming apart. You also see in this pattern the cracks that run across the road, and that is actually one of the things that we end up having as big a problem with as any in Minnesota, and those are called thermal cracks or transverse cracks. You can imagine you have this thing out there that's 5 miles long, and it gets cold and it wants to shrink. Well, it can't shrink all of it all at once, so instead of shrinking down, it shrinks like this and ends up snapping at various intervals depending upon how well the pavement reacts to the weather. Now, we are getting better with using higher-grade asphalts and polymer modification when we reconstruct roads that we have actually less of this phenomenon, but the vast majority of your pavements out there have these kinds of cracks in them. And as you showed in the video, these kind of cracks let water in. So you essentially have that spring, that late spring effect in those vicinities all year round, because there's always water right in the pavement right underneath those areas. So you have areas that are good, but you also have these areas next to these thermal cracks that are quite weak. When you're designing a pavement, the pavement on the left, the new pavement, you can increase the structural capacity quite a bit when it's brand new by adding just not a great deal more asphalt layer to the pavement. But once it's been in service, as the pavement on the right has been, and it gets those thermal cracks, the moisture's down in the base, it does not add that much structural capacity or not add that same amount of life when you do an overlay. Quite often we'll do an overlay, and soon thereafter you'll see a crack right above where the old crack was, and that area is where the road is going to deteriorate and cause the poor ride. Just some numbers that you can kind of refer to. Now, this is sort of an imaginary road built up in midair. Now, this hasn't got anything to do with traffic control or mobilizing the contractor or striping or any of those kinds of costs that are part of a real project. This is just this imaginary piece of pavement up in midair. So for just 2 inches of bituminous overlay, it costs about $50,000 for two lanes 24 feet wide, nothing to do with the shoulders. Now, if you go out and you're trying to build a new asphalt pavement two-lane, the pavement structure and the gravel underneath would cost you about $250,000 per mile. If you're building, say, a four-lane asphalt pavement, higher type facility in the metro area, you're looking at about $1 million a mile. And when you're up to concrete, say 10 inches of concrete in the metro area on four lanes, would be about $1.2 million per mile. Now, we do have, as I mentioned, the pavement management system where we go out and collect data on every piece of state highway. We have the easiest term to talk to with people is the smoothness measurement. As you can see, there's five different categories that we sort of break the state into in terms of any individual road. It's ranked from one to five in those five different categories. And this is the data from 2004 is available on that website as far as what individual roads have which kind of smoothness number. And just to look at the past numbers, we have kind of two rankings or two things we measure ourselves on. One is how many smooth roads we have, how many roads that people enjoy driving on, and the other thing we keep track of is how many roads that are so bad or in such rough condition that people avoid driving on them. So we would like to see in our principal arterial system at least 70% of our roads good roads. And as you can see, since 2000, the green bar there has been dropping, and we are now in 2003, and we do have the numbers for 2004 that show we are under 70% of our principal arterial system is below that good category, which is below the goals we have set for ourselves. The other category is those roads that people avoid, and our goal is that we have less than 2% of the roads in the state trunk highway network that are in such bad condition that people avoid them. And as you can see, since the year 2000, we've gone from less than 1%, now we're over 2.6%, and this year we're approaching about 3% of our system is in a condition where people would prefer not to drive on it. And I guess with that, I'll just answer any questions you might have.
I have a question. Is there any little snippets of longevity concrete versus asphalt? You pick your four-lane asphalt or your four-lane concrete. Length of service and repairability and all that?
Well, that question kind of goes towards what we do. When we're reconstructing a road, we have a process called the pavement selection process where we look at typical longevity for concrete versus bituminous. Certainly you have the first cost of each of them and you have the cost of maintaining them. Asphalt, you are typically out more often milling and overlaying, where concrete has a lower cost. So to say, I mean, it's hard to, on any given location, one might be cheaper than the other based on the aggregate availability and things like that. That's one of the things that drives it more than anything is what kinds of aggregate are available. Mm. And the other thing that drives it is how strong is the soil that's in place. If you have really weak soil or really strong soil, that can help or hurt the two different kinds of pavement. So that's an ongoing. Certainly we have an asphalt industry that says they're always best. We have a concrete industry that says they're always best. But we do have a very detailed process to compare those two. So I don't know if that answers your question, but the answer, I guess, is until you tell me where you're going to build the road and how much traffic you're going to have on the road, I wouldn't be able to tell you which one's better, asphalt or concrete. So we do have a very precise process for making that determination.
Not even varies on the interstate. Some sections are asphalt and some are concrete, I think.
That's correct. And again, it's two major inputs are the in-place soils and traffic volumes, and then it gets into the cost of the local available aggregate.
Okay. Representative Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You asked a question there that I was interested in also. But Mr. Turgeon, it seems like the engineering studies on roads are a very long process because you get them down and then they're used. Earlier we heard that
you know, a lot of the roads last, you know, 50 years before they're needing rebuilding. Well, during that time, somewhere you're learning some information, I'm sure, on them. I was curious about, you know, when you put together the gravel equivalent on a road section to figure that out. Has that engineering, I mean, are we able to use, you know, better aggregates and different things so that we're actually being more efficient in our building of roads that can take these weights? You know, we're all getting pushed to increase the hauling limits on trucks. Well, what is the road construction doing in related to that?
Well, as I mentioned, one of the best things for asphalt is we have been able to choose asphalt cements that are less likely to crack. As far as structural capacity, there are new ways of looking at the actual structural capacity of the road that you can model with a computer, that, you know, the loading and the deflection, similar to the models we use when you're designing a building or a bridge. The tough thing with pavements is they are so heavily dependent upon climate and that underlying layer and what the climate does to that underlying layer that, you know, we can do those things, but then there is some limitations as to how reliable they are.
Representative Anderson.
He's got a follow-up.
I just had one follow-up, and that is, you know, we get beat up here in the north with the freeze-thaw cycles. Is there, and we know that when you get rapid rise in temperatures, we get the blowouts and things on the roads. Is there prolonged hot weather? I mean, is it doing damage that we don't get in other areas of the United States, for example, where it is hot all the time? Are they getting other things? I guess what I'm kind of heading at is, on our road construction, it seems like we get whacked really hard on dealing with the spring thaw stuff up here, and I don't know what that does on the hot end.
On the hot end, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the hot air, or the hot problem is primarily with asphalt and having it become plastic, having it move. And we do see that at intersections occasionally, and we do see that during hot weather, and it's primarily, again, slow-moving, heavy weights, hot weather where the asphalt gets soft and begins to go plastic and move around. We don't have that problem as severe as they do in some other parts of the country.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Turgeon, to give you a little background on what I'm going to ask you, the city of Buffalo a number of years ago was having trouble with their asphalt streets, and they decided to maybe aesthetically upgrade. So in upgrading, they tore out all of their asphalt, and they put in the brick pattern type of a layered street, and they had it crisscrossed, so it made it look real pretty and everything like that. do you have a cost estimate on what that type of a thing would relay? Are you giving us some costs here? Also, the question is, they've replaced this now 3 times because it's heaved, and we had heaving problems before, but they're on their 4th time now. I just see they've in different places just put in asphalt and forgot about putting back the brick.
I have
Mr.
Chair, I have really no idea what that stuff costs, but, you know, it's all about spreading loads, and unfortunately those block pavers aren't really set up to do that, and they also aren't set up very good to shed the water because the water gets in between them. So,
well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Turgeon, would you think that the engineer would do the same type of underlayment that you would do with an asphalt road, or some type of a, you know, going down deep to get rid of the heaving part of the problems? I don't know what engineers look at from a standpoint of determining their circumstance, but or do they consult the state at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know if it's on the... They wouldn't have consulted with MnDOT quite likely if it's on the state aid system. They may have gotten someone from our state aid office to review and approve it. It is very much, again, as you mentioned, the best thing they could do is dig out quite deep and start with some pretty thick layers of sand to try and improve that situation. But ultimately, it is very difficult to make it uniform enough to pave with block pavers a significant area. I'm not familiar with anywhere on the MnDOT system where we've got those.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Turgeon, if you do know of anybody in your office, I'd like to have some answers from them. Thank you.
That's not an area we've done much with.
Do you ever drive Minneapolis St. Paul on 94?
Mr. Chair, yes, I occasionally do, yes.
Okay, occasionally is not enough. You gotta do it every day, so. Okay, I think we have typical failure mode for Minnesota pavements. And your three shots here occurring on that, but that's another story.
That road was actually built in 1965 and it's far outlived its intended useful life.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to move on now, and thank you very much, Mr. Turgeon, and we will now move to Daniel Gordon, State Bridge Engineer. Get a shot at the bridges.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dan Dorgan. I'm the State Bridge Engineer with MnDOT, and I'll be briefly giving you an overview of bridge design, loadings, load postings, and the impact of heavier trucks on bridges. There is a handout that should be at your desk that was passed out earlier that covers roughly 10 slides or so I have. I'll try to be brief. I know time is getting a little lengthy here. You've heard from Mr. Hayes, Mr. Turgeon on pavements. Last but not least, we'll cover bridges. And although I've probably got the least time and I'm last on the agenda here, I want to emphasize for my friends in the pavement community, the bridges are extremely important. In fact, we tease them that the purpose of pavements is to connect our bridges. But that'll be the last joke I'll try. What I'd like to start with then is some of the factors that influence a bridge's ability to carry truck loads. And first of all, one of the primary issues is the age of the bridge and the load it was designed for. That's one of the factors listed here. Another one is the concentration of load that it receives from the truck. And as an example, the most severe loadings on bridges are short, very compact, and heavy loads. A 28-foot-long garbage truck or ready-mix hauler truck that may weigh 30 tons has a greater impact on bridges than would a 65-foot-long semi that weighs 40 tons, even though it's a heavier load. So if you're able to spread that load out, it creates less stress on the bridges. The last of the factors that I've noted here, bridges, as they age, they deteriorate, and depending on what type of deterioration has occurred, that will have an influence on what kind of load the bridge may be able to carry. Now, I mentioned that design loads being one of these factors. Older bridges, and we have quite a few older bridges in the state, in general, they're able to carry less load, and a lot of that just deals with the era that they were designed in. All bridges in the U.S. are designed by a National Bridge Code. It's developed by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. ASHTO is the name for that group. So all states are designing according to the same code. And over the years, we've increased those design loads as the population of trucks out on the roadway has changed. And the upper diagram shows a three-axle truck. This would have been typical prior to World War II. Generally, these trucks were about a 15-ton, 20-ton total weight. With the 1940s came the semi-tractor trailer, so design weights were increased as truck weights increased out on the roadways. And again, in 1988, Minnesota moved its weights up to yet again to a heavier truck. So our over the years, then we've tried to increase those design loads as the weights have changed on the highways. But the load used in design is key when considering this older bridge population. And I mentioned earlier we have quite a few bridges that of an older age on our system. As bridge engineers, we design bridges to last anywhere 75 to 100 years. That's the type of time frame we're looking at. So given that lifespan, a lot of changes, of course, occur in 75 or 100 years. And it's not uncommon to find some of these 80, 90-year-old bridges out on our system, many of them designed for, again, only that 20-ton truck. Not all of those are a problem. some were over-designed, thankfully, when we look back on it. As engineers, we're happy for the designer back in the 1920s that put more material, more steel in that structure than was needed by design code in those days. Some are very short, so you can only get half of a truck on them. So those are able to take the loads. But the nevertheless, there's quite a few of them, and as you can see from the numbers, almost 800 on the trunk highway system, over 1,600 on our local system that was designed in these era of lighter loads. Just as a piece of information, the oldest bridge at the moment on the trunk highway system is 1877. That's actually the bridge that's in the picture. It was originally erected in Sauk Center, Minnesota in 1877, dismantled in the 1930s and moved up to northern Minnesota. So right now this is still in service up on Highway 65 north of Hibbing. But, you know, when you think of that structure, certainly not designed for modern loads, not even a truck wasn't even envisioned at the time this bridge went into service. So that kind of points to some of these problems with our older structures. And the oldest bridge on the local system is a stone arch in Scott County, I think. It's 1878. Now, we try to protect older bridges, and the method we do that is we're not only protecting the bridge, but also so the motorist that uses them is by, I'm sorry, I went in the wrong direction there, is by bridge load postings. So each bridge is load rated by an engineer to determine the allowable load, and bridges that can't carry the legal load of 80,000 pounds, those would be posted. And in 2000, we had a little over 450 bridges posted in Minnesota. Those are the dots that are shown on your map. So that reflects the number of bridges that are posted, and again, it's to prevent damage and certainly to avoid the worst outcome for some of these older bridges, and thankfully I can say this is a photo from South Dakota just last December. This was a truck, as you can see in the lower right, there's a posting sign that reads 11 tons. This truck was carrying about 37 tons. So when bridges are posted by a county engineer or by the state, we certainly mean it. It's meant to protect those that use the bridge. As the years have gone by, and again, truckloads with those increases, it has put a strain on these older bridges. And some of the impacts of those heavier loads include increased fatigue damage to bridge decks, to beams and trusses. And this is basically the pounding that a bridge takes as a heavy load comes across and moves off that structure. I know the pavement presentations earlier cited damage caused by increased weights. For bridges, just to give you a feel for it, a 20% increase in weight almost doubles the type of the fatigue damage or the level of damage that bridge will receive. So those increased weights, if you're an older structure, certainly shorten the life of those bridges. What's depicted in this photo is another one of our older bridges on the trunk highway system. This is on Trunk Highway 2 near Grand Rapids, Minnesota. About 1931, I believe, is the vintage on this structure. This photo shows some in the upper left some of the damage on this bridge. That maintenance worker is standing near the center line of the roadway where a hole is punched through the concrete deck. And on the far right then is the photo of one of the maintenance workers down below working to remove the bad concrete, getting ready to try to patch this and keep it again in service. We expect to replace this bridge. I believe it's scheduled next year. But again, a bridge that's suffering quite a bit of fatigue damage from the heavy loads that are carried on Highway 2. The lower right shows I mentioned fatigue cracks in steel. The lower right shows a 35W over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis. This is a fatigue crack. It's a diagonal line that's running to the upper right of the picture. The hole that's shown there is the hole that our maintenance forces would have drilled to arrest that crack to stop it from progressing. That's a common fix for fatigue cracks. Mm. It may seem crude, but it is effective. So that's how we try to repair these or arrest the damage. And the last slide I had to show was just a summary of what the impact of increasing legal truck weights by another 10% would be, going from 88,000 pounds in Minnesota. It would result in an additional posting beyond what we've already noted of approximately 500 bridges. And again, the impact is most severe on that county and local system where the population of these older bridges is heavier. So the dots on the map then would reflect the locations that we would estimate where those structures are located. So I know that's really been a quick run through on bridge load postings. Again, I'd like to emphasize, keep in mind the older bridges, the large population, particularly on the county system of those older bridges, so as increased truck weights are considered, it does have a severe impact on that system. And with that, I'm open to questions, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any bridges that you've had to close, or eliminate the one horse and one man or something? Or?
Well, to one horse, one man's been a few years probably since we had that limitation, but we have had to, on the trunk highway system, the last bridge I recall that we closed was the Lake Street Bridge between Minneapolis-St. Paul. I think we closed that in the, or I should back up on the high bridge, I think, in St. Paul was closed in the 1980s. On the local side, though, there are quite a few bridges currently closed within the state. I don't have the count or the number, but I believe that several hundred are closed on the local system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. Just a couple of quick questions. First, how do you enforce these limits? I think it would be somewhat difficult, but you must have some mechanism. And how many violators can you typically catch?
Well, the means of enforcement, of course, are by load posting. You know, our first hope is that those truckers respect those loads and use alternate routes for their own safety and for the safety of their cargoes. But really the reliance on enforcement would be by state patrol. And so that's, directly a function of how many patrolmen you could put out there and how many you can devote to load and weight regulation. I think it's safe to say for our state patrol, the biggest issues are traffic safety. So in enforcement of load, you don't devote as many officers to that as you would towards traffic safety issues. So it is tough to enforce. The enforcement is, I think they do the best they can with the forces they have. But yes.
Just one other quick question.
Representative Horsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This prompted my thought when you showed the 35W bridge over the Mississippi River. So, MnDOT or counties or whoever has jurisdiction over these bridges must have a core of engineers that go out and do these inspections. It seems like there's a lot of work there. Are there any staffing issues? Are there enough personnel to go out and regularly do these inspections?
We are devoting enough staff to it. Staffing is always a concern, but it's actually a federal requirement that our bridges be inspected. And within Minnesota, it's either on an annual or, for the newer bridges, on a two-year cycle. So we are meeting those requirements for bridge inspection. It's a particular strain on the county system because of sometimes the smaller staff there to complete those inspections, but they are being completed. So, that is the one thing I'd like to report is that I think between the counties and MnDOT, we're very vigilant on the condition of the bridges and do complete those inspections. I can't speak for the counties how much staff they need. I think they're somewhat short staff trying to accomplish that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Easton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dorgan, you mentioned here older bridges carrying less load, and you said that some of the bridges were designed for not even thinking of a truck of the capacity that they have now today. What is the projection of MnDOT or your division in regards to, say, 50 years from now or 20 years? How far out do you set a schedule as to, we're looking at 10 tons, we're looking at counties and people wanting to say we want 10-ton roads. Well, you're going to have to then move that, I would think, that look at the bridges and say, can we carry the capacity? How far ahead do you look in your projections as to what bridges should be carrying?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it isn't a set number of years we look ahead. As I noted on one of those earlier slides, though, over the years we have increased the design weight that we use for bridges to reflect that population, and the last increase was 1988. For 10-ton type axles, the bridges designed today have no problems with the legal loads and even the loads we permit. we really don't try to project 50 years out. We certainly try to add quite a factor of safety into our designs to accommodate some of those increased weights over the years, but it's not per se a certain number of years we look ahead. The bridges we designed are designed in recognition that the weights will be heavier.
Any idea what the cost of bringing the current shortfall and bridge construction to where you should have it, including 35 before I drive across to the end?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, one thing I'd like to, the issue on 35 has been corrected, so you feel free going home tonight and don't worry about that crossing. As far as the cost, I think maybe I'd put it in terms of, particularly when you look at these local bridges, the average cost to replace a local bridge is $300,000 to $400,000. Now, some of those, of course, can be, if you're crossing the Mississippi, you can spend $20 million to replace them, but right now there's about 500 posted, and so, you know, quickly doing the math in my head, you know, we've got a couple hundred million right there just to address local bridges. I don't have a number statewide for you off the top of my head on the total replacement.
That's close. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much, all three of you, for keeping us awake.
Thank you.
House File 945, Representative Earhart, you want to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File 945, Mr. Chairman, and I would move that this bill be passed as we're going to amend it and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, and your amendment? Is an A1 amendment?
It's the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman, and what it does is, let me move it, I move the H094.